Hey, deserving listeners. I was recently on a podcast in which they asked me a lot of questions about domestic violence and intimate partner violence, and I thought I would just share that with you here. The podcast that I was on is called Case of the Sunday Scaries. I believe what the podcast is about is true crime, and Case of the Sunday Scaries, I think, refers to the experience that a lot of people might be able to relate to, in which you wake up Sunday morning having gone on a date Saturday night, and you're thinking about the date, and you're thinking, was that person abusive, or that person scared me, or I don't know exactly. I should have asked them what the title of the podcast was referring to, but I think it's something like that. The podcast is hosted by Elise Delbaum and Annie Hochstein. Some of you might know Elise Delbaum from The Bachelor or The Bachelorette. I'm not sure which one. So she has a podcast called Case of the Sunday Scaries, and let's get to it.
Welcome back to Case of the Sunday Scaries. I'm Elise.
And I'm Annie.
And today you might recognize our guest from his popular Psychology in Seattle podcast and YouTube, but the incredible man that is the face of those channels is Dr. Kurt Konda, a psychotherapist. Did I pronounce that correctly?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I did a lot of checking on that one. And professor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
You and I got to speak a few years back on another podcast, and I'm just so happy to have you on Case of the Sunday Scaries today to discuss something that is unfortunately so close to my heart. Domestic violence obviously is a topic I wish we didn't have to discuss, but it's so present in our cases covering true crime, but also in our society. And so I'm just grateful to have you here to answer some of our listeners' questions.
Dr. Honda, Elise recently introduced me to your YouTube channel. I'm already a fan. So it's great to meet you. I heard in one of your episodes that you used to work with perpetrators of domestic abuse. Is that still an area that you work in?
I loosely do, in that the clients that I work with will occasionally exhibit abusive, coercive behavior. But I, earlier in my career, was more concentrated in that work, in which I worked with mandated by law because they had been convicted of a crime and were mandated by law to go to a court-mandated treatment program that tried to help perpetrators to not perpetrate again. And so I wasn't the DV specialist, that was someone else, but I was a therapist helping them on the mental health side. But 90% of what we did had to do with perpetration reduction.
I bet you've heard some very interesting things from people.
Well, I had to dismantle all of my myths, my misunderstandings of these individuals in my mind. I had a common understanding of them as being these evil, aggressive, constantly angry people. But when I met them, they were vulnerable, sad, lonely. Doesn't justify what they did at all. But I spent a lot of time confused and thinking, are we just attracting like these really different sort of perpetrators? But it turned out not so. And then I had to completely rebuild my understanding from scratch and learn from them, and also start applying other models of understanding to human development and attachment reactivity to these individuals, and have a much more accurate understanding of these individuals in general. There's a lot of different paths to abuse, of course, but generally speaking, the common profile of someone is someone who is 100% not justified in doing any of the abusive behaviors, but on the inside, they have a very warped understanding of trying to retain relationships. They're actually trying to establish attachment security through control, abuse, harm, violence. And they learned it when they were young, or it worked when they were young, or something, it was modeled to them. And they have no other way of being able to show or to bid or to communicate that they are feeling lonely, or they're feeling rejected, or they're feeling isolated. They're worried they're going to lose their partner. You know, all of us have those experiences where you see your partner look at someone else, for example, and you just have a little bit of a thought. And how do we react to that? Well, a minority, but a sizable, noticeable minority of people, the only answer to that question is control, abuse, harm, coercion, belittling, gaslighting, all that stuff. They think that is the answer to the problem that we all experience. The rest of us have, you know, non-abusive ways of dealing with it, hopefully, but we might have also problematic ways of dealing with
right.
it, you know? like running away or drinking or cheating or something, but it's not harmful and criminal the way that these individuals do.
I think that would be hard. I mean, you touched on it, but especially for myself and having the experience that I've already shared through this podcast, being in a situation of very, very high control, it would be very hard for me to separate my experience and then talking to these people and kind of having empathy for what their journey is, right? Because you're saying that it's not always something that is maybe a conscious behavior. It's more something that has been modeled to them, right? And so, yeah, I can't imagine it would be hard to go in with some very preconceived notions and then try to set those aside.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, if you don't want to have empathy or compassion for these people, even though I'm presenting an opportunity for that, then don't. People often will conflate what I'm saying with a recommendation that one accept this behavior or put up with it or see the inner child in these individuals and try to help them. And the answer, no. In my personal life, when someone abuses me, which has happened in my 52 years on this planet, occasionally it happens, and I'm stuck with that person for one reason or another, and I have compassion for them, I know where it comes from. I'm a therapist. I'm always analyzing everyone. So it's just a matter of course. And I have that perspective. And yet, I distance myself. I separate myself from them. I'm not their, if they were my client, then obviously I don't, I'm talking about people in my personal life. I'm not their therapist. It's not my fault. I might actually even contribute to their attachment insecurity that might cause them to be even more likely to be triggered in the future. That's not my responsibility. I only have one life to live. I'm not going to sacrifice myself for other people's criminal, abusive, harmful activity. I'm just not going to do that.
Yeah. The word I've been trying to learn more about is boundaries. So I feel like we can all benefit from that.
Yeah.
But after Elise shared her story and then we discussed another case in our series, we opened it up to our listeners and we asked them to write in their questions. We have a lot of good ones for you and I want to get into those. But before I do, I actually have a question for you from myself. So I'm the first one. I feel so honored. I have never personally gone through an abusive relationship, thankfully. But what stood out to me when listening to Elisa's story and then also Molly's story was that there seems to be so many similarities in behaviors or how the abuse started. What are some of the warning signs and behaviors of abusers that people should be aware of if they can? I understand sometimes it might be where you don't even realize it's happening, but do you have any red flags or warning signs that really stick out to you?
Yeah, many. I actually jotted some down in preparation for this, just so I could not make a mistake about this. One is belittling speech. Someone who belittles you makes you feel like you're small. The other part of this is that even if you know the warning signs, you might have been through so much abuse yourself or mistreatment that it feels normal to you, or you have a hard time noting that you deserve better or something. So there's a lot of factors that play into whether or not you're going to be able to protect yourself. But if you want warning signs, yeah, belittling speech doesn't mean, so all these warning signs doesn't mean the individual will become abusive, but it's a sign.
Something to take note of.
Yeah, something that red flag for sure. Never admitting fault or apologizing. This is a big one. It's annoying to begin with, but if someone was doing this, it would be a red flag that they might become abusive in the future. And by abusive, it might help to define that. It can be violent. It can be obviously nonviolent, but essentially it can be controlling as well, but it also might not have a theme of control. Essentially, it's making you as the individual feel as though you're walking on eggshells. You feel intimidated. You feel like you're not good enough. You are dependent on them, overly dependent on them. There's a lot of different angles to it. So we should expand it, not just hitting. Obviously, there's a lot of different versions of this. Basically, it harms you. It's a harmful style of relationship that ends up psychologically and in other dimensions. It harms you in your life. So belittling speech, never admitting fault, frequent jealousy. So frequent triggers of jealousy. It's normal to get jealous. Everyone does. But if someone is frequently getting jealous, and certainly the way that they get jealous is a big indicator. If someone's just like, hey, like, how come you're spending all your time with this other person? That's one sort of signal or bid for more attention or something.
Right.
But if someone says like, I don't want you dressing like that because I don't want people looking at you in that way or something, or, really? You're going to hang out with those people again? I don't know. I don't like those people. I think they're a bad influence on, that kind of messaging is a huge red flag, actually. Making you feel bad for spending time with friends and family, commenting on how you dress. Toxic masculinity, actually adherence to traditional gender norms is a sign. It's a red flag. It's a factor. Aggression, alpha male talk, anger when they should be expressing sadness or fear or something, very sure of themselves. Some very traditional, and this is kind of a tough one, you know, because some people really look for, based on what they're looking for in a partner, they want that person who opens the door for them. They want that person who pays for dinner. They want that person who is protective or sees themselves as the strong one or something. And that can be a good thing, but it can also be a humongous red flag. It could be admirable that the person is on top of their stuff and is there to help you, is there to protect you. But it is a potential tip of the iceberg to a general idea that they want to control you. They don't want you to have your own agency of opening up your own door. They don't want you to have money to pay for things because they don't want you to have freedom, because they're worried that if you have that control and that power, that you will do things that will lead you to leaving them. And so they're on a mission to create a holistic control over various aspects of your life, because they believe that's the only way to attachment security, which is not true. And I should add an asterisk that there are psychopathic, sadistic, abusive people who are not doing it for attachment reasons. They're being abusive just because they don't have empathy.
For sport?
Yeah, exactly. But that's really rare. I mean, you could go your whole life and never run into a psychopath or a sadistic personality individual. And there's a lot of misinterpretation. There's a lot of over-labeling of that, because it could certainly look like that. And it takes, you know, someone that sort of understands that to be able to differentiate the two. But anyway, rigid love bombing. So is another sign. If someone is really pressuring you to move faster in a relationship, move in, get married, have kids, say you love them, go exclusive, you know, all those kinds of steps. There's nothing wrong with being in love with someone and being like, oh my God, I want to be with you all the time. But if you push back and they get upset, then that's what we call love bombing. There's nothing wrong with having tremendous motivation to be with someone, but if they truly love you, then they'll let you push back a little bit. They'll be like, well, bummer, but I'll wait because I love you so much. I don't want to pressure you. And again, a lot of people misinterpret this, because for some people, based on the way they were raised, when someone's love bombing you and you push back, you're just like, yeah, I don't know if I'm ready. You know, I just came out of a kind of a bad relationship and I don't know if I'm ready to move forward. And your partner is just like, how come you're doing this to me? I mean, I love you so much. Like, we're made for each other. Why are you hurting me like this? It's so like, why, you know, don't, I'm not your past boyfriend. Like, and person might genuinely love you. And so you're receiving it as, whoa, not only does this person love me, not only does this person see me in a good light, not only does this person make me feel secure. You know, I'm the only person in this person's life. I feel, you know, it's a good feeling. And when I push back, it's like, actually that proves to me how much they love me. Because if I were to push back and they were to say, okay, you know, I'll let that one go, then that means they don't love me times 10, you know, they only love me times 5. And that's a huge misunderstanding of what to look for in the beginning of a relationship. And it's a massive beginning to that cycle. Cause once you give in on that, then they learn all I have to do is just lay it on thick and eventually you'll give in. You know what I mean? To say how much it hurts me that you're not letting me do this, or we're not becoming more and more enmeshed, you know. For long, it's something like, I can't believe that you want your own bank account. How come, you know, you're just separate from me? Like, you don't love me. And then, you know, it just goes further down that. You know, I can't believe you want to spend time with your family. I thought we had a good marriage. And that's the seduction of it, right? Because especially if you've gone through a lot of attachment insecurity, you're like, oh my God, I've never felt so secure. This person, I'm the only person in this person's life. And this can be real, you know, the way it's portrayed in the media often, it's fake. But for a lot of these perpetrators, it's real. They really do genuinely love you. They have their own attachment insecurities and their own problems. And so you are their savior and you feel that and
feel the weight of it.
Yeah. And it's attractive. It's secure. It's like, I finally found some, you know, I've dated all these people that never wanted to commit. And this person, you know, other signs are emotional volatility, particularly around attachment and security. You know, if they really get triggered and fly off the handle, there's a lot of people like that, but that's a sign of things. Also, a kind of a random sign is when they give you messages that you don't know what you're doing in bed. It's a common theme that they will try to humiliate you or coerce you. You know, there's various different angles to this. So basically, they will make you feel inadequate sexually, as if you're not doing things right, or you're not open enough, or you're not into it enough, or something. And it's an expression of their own insecurity. They need extreme overt indications of, you know, absolute love and security. And in bed, there can be insecurities, there can be uncertainties, particularly in the beginning. There's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I would like this, or are you into this? Mm-hmm. Is there something you want to change? But it's another thing to be like, you're not doing it right. How come you're doing it that way? Is that way you've always done it? You need to do it this way. You know, you need to open up more. You know, there's a belittling, a very self-assured way of talking to people. The last two are talking negatively about their past partners. Again, it's not a huge indication, but hearing people, you know, if you met someone and there were a couple signs, but they were like pretty good friends with their past partners and you had evidence to believe that that was true, then that would be a tick in the column of not, you know, but abusive individuals, you know, they tend to burn a lot of bridges in their intimate relationship. Also, a history of intimate partner violence in their family, right? If they talk about their parents being violent with each other in some way, I wouldn't reject someone on that detail, but it'd be another potential sign. Yeah.
Those are all very interesting, because some of them I'm just sitting here nodding going, yep, like ding, ding, that rings a bell. And, you know, Annie and I covered Molly's case, which was so tragic last episode. And it's funny because one thing we brought up is I was saying, if you ever hear my ex is crazy over and over again, like just be aware. So it's interesting that you said that. One thing that I hadn't heard before that you were talking about is, and I don't want to go too deep into it, but the traditional gender roles in relationships. And that stuck out to me because I always say, like, my dad is my person. I lucked out in the dad category, and I have amazing parents, both of them, but me and my dad just communicate really well. But they showed me and chose to have very traditional values. And just to clarify for people that hear that and say, well, what's wrong with wanting those things or those, you know, traditional gender roles? And my understanding of what you're saying is that you have the choice. Mm-hmm. That's the difference of saying, yeah, I want a joint bank account. Yes, I want him to take care of the finances and I take care of the children, or whatever you see those roles as. So it's not necessarily a negative unless you lose your voice in that. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, it's just a red flag. It's just a yellow flag, if you will. If you were in a, you know, the first five dates and you had that in addition to four of the other ones, then you should have a question mark there. And you should start to watch out for things. Just traditional gender roles on its own doesn't mean anything. It just means that that's people's preference. But yeah, choice. But it also kind of depends on how, right? If it's just paying for things, or a way of a sort of a vibe of I'm strong, I will protect you, like, I'll be in charge of the security. Like in my house, I'm in charge of the security of the house. My wife, Stacy, doesn't, she's concerned with the security of the house. You know, as a content provider yourself, you know, people say things, it's terrifying. And so I'm a guy, so it's less so of an issue for me, obviously, but you know, it's still kind of an issue. And so I take that on and I consider that to be my man responsibility. I would feel less of a man, mm-hmm, if I deferred to her on that, you know. And
sure,
you know, there's nothing wrong with those kinds of preferences and that kind of, you might even call it like a romantic preference of some sort. But if my wife said, you're doing it a way I don't want you to do it, I want to do it, and I would let her do it, you know. Sure. I don't need to do it. I'm doing it because I think it fits within our relationship in terms of the, you know, the labor distribution, but my masculinity, my self-esteem isn't dependent on being seen as the man of the house. So that's the difference. Because when you have someone who is very fragile in their masculinity and they need you to adhere to certain gender norms and they need to exhibit that, then that is a problem, because it's not out of just a preference or a romantic vibe. It's a desperation, because they're running from extreme low self-esteem and a constant worry of not being seen as the perfect man, and thus they're going to lose their partners. And so they're constantly trying to assert themselves as that, and also it justifies their abusive behavior. But it also, they've been taught that that makes them worthy. And if they can't establish themselves to everyone around them that they are the perfect toxic male, they have this idea, because they were taught it, that no one will want to be with them. They'll be a weak, worthless woman man that will never have anyone love them or respect them.
That makes sense. I'm going to revert back to talking about my relationship through this, just to keep our listeners who wrote in anonymous and kind of take their questions and deflect it onto what I've already shared publicly, just to keep that hidden. So in my relationship, I felt very, very quickly that he created, and I mean, I was a part of it, but it was not a mentality that I was used to in relationships. This sort of, it's us against the world, Bonnie and Clyde, telling me things, like you said, and when you were discussing warning flags that were negative about friends and family, and almost making me question if they didn't have my best interests at heart. And I describe it as feeling like my world constantly was getting smaller and smaller, almost without me realizing it. And through therapy, I obviously understood that that's part of the isolation tactic. Can you talk about why isolation is so important and like a common tactic used by perpetrators of abuse, regardless of the type of abuse?
Well, I might use slightly different words. The word tactic often implies volition. And sure, a lot of these individuals, it's not a voluntary plan that they have. They're not waking up in the morning and say, okay, if I isolate her, if I put her down, if I gaslight her, they're not doing that. They're reacting in the moment. And their reactivity is, it has this very destructive effect that is secondary to it. They might kind of understand that that's what the secondary effect is, but that's not usually where it's generated from. There are psychopaths and Machiavellian dark triad, dark, you know, people who are like that, but, and people will run across them at times, but generally speaking, when I speak about perpetrators, that's not the case. It wasn't the case when I treated them, that the psychopaths never entered my treatment program. It was always these other folks. So anyway, I'll use slightly different language, and the effect is still the same. It's still harmful. But the us against the world, there's really two often aspects to it. One is that because of their attachment injuries, they've never had secure attachments. And so when they meet someone that they believe and have hopes, massive amounts of hopes, that this person will be an attachment that is secure and safe and dedicated and long-lasting and loving, and then a childish version of attachment, reactivity, and hopes will come forward. So an 18-month-old child does, you know, they have a similar mindset. It's not us, they wouldn't say us against the world, but the child would be like, it's me and mommy. We are one. Mommy loves me. I love mommy. And mommy's always there for me. And I'm solely interested in what is going on with her. And I want her to be happy, and she wants me to be happy, and she wakes me up in the morning, and she dresses me, and she feeds me, and she, you know, like the whole thing, it's all encompassing, and every child deserves that. But a lot of people don't get that. And so they retain that need, that very, 18-month-old version of that need into adulthood, maybe even until they die, because they never get it, unfortunately. But so when they finally meet someone, all of that need and attachment need comes pouring out. And to them, they word it in that way. It feels it's us against the world, because it's an all-encompassing love. It's not just romantic companionship love. It's deep, deep, deep dependence. And for a time, they are able to be vulnerable with the target because they feel safe in the moment. Often it's in the beginning before there's any kind of disappointment. And so it'll be framed as a tactic, but for the vast majority of individuals that do this, even though it is abusive, it's from their heart. They're desperate. And again, I want to remind everyone, I'm not saying you're supposed to be with them because they're damaged. I'm saying run. They need to go to therapy.
Right.
Let them, you know, recover after 15 years. Maybe you can be friends, maybe after that point. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is that they do want you all to themselves in the same way that a child wants their parent all to themselves. Not that, oh my God, I'm so deeply in love with you. It's us against the world. And they also, because of their track record, they have a perspective that the world is against them. They don't have a rosy idea of the world and people. They don't trust other people. They've been really disappointed. And so when they finally meet someone, it's a black and white experience. You are good. You're all good. You're all wonderful. You're all secure. Our relationship is perfect. You can do no wrong. And the rest of the world sucks because I've experienced the nuances of the world and it's been so disappointing. And they're also communicating, don't be with anyone else because I need you all to myself, and any other attachment or interest or hobby or job or anything, it will terrify me because I will worry I'm going to lose you. And I'm so desperately in need of you all the time that I need you to only be focused on me. So it's us against the world.
That definitely makes sense that you would see any other relationship or, you know, like you said, attachment to a job or career as a threat to their time with you and their bond with you. That makes perfect sense. Something I've seen you discuss a few times in your videos and something that really grinds my gears as well is when, I don't know when this started, but it seems like in the past 2 years, everyone thinks that they have gone to school and have a doctorate degree in therapy. But it also feels very invalidating sometimes to something that I've gone through when people are throwing out the term gaslighting, especially when they're really just describing a disagreement or an argument. And, oh, he gaslighted me and, you know, et cetera, however they decide to use it. But it feels very frustrating from someone who's actually been through that experience. Can you describe to our listeners and clear the air of what gaslighting actually is, please?
The caveat I'll say is that I've been a clinician, a professor for 25 plus years, and I have been really trying to get the public to be aware of all this stuff and the need for therapy and, you know, relationships and abuse. And 25 years ago, there was very little awareness about any of this. And so as awareness increases, you're going to have people misunderstanding terms, which is not a great side effect. But the bigger issue here is the celebration of everyone in my field who has been trying to propagate these ideas and raise awareness. And so that, you know, this is a, you know, it sucks, but it's a result of something that's overall good. The fact that even people know the word to begin with to misuse it is surprising to me. So to define it, it has been defined in the clinical literature for decades, and it refers to abusive relationships. It's not a one-off conversation you're having with someone. And so I spent some time looking at the clinical literature and thinking about it myself and thinking about how people use it. There are three different definitions, three different types, if you will. One is what we'll call purposeful gaslighting, which is the way most people refer to gaslighting. They're referring to volitional, purposeful gaslighting. And this is when someone goes on a campaign, so it's a longer term thing, to purposefully manipulate someone through psychological means to have the individual lack confidence in their own memory, perception, and judgment, sanity in general. So it's a campaign to purposely manipulate someone so that that individual questions their own sanity, their own memory. They don't think they can gauge what really happened, you know, because they're constantly told, you're wrong, that didn't happen, you're crazy, you always do that, you're always overreacting, your brain doesn't work right, you know, all these messages. And eventually, you know, if you're isolated, you start to believe it because it seems like, well, they seem really sure of themselves and I'm not so sure. And so that's purposeful gaslighting. Number two is the more common, you know, behavioral version of gaslighting, which I call non-purposeful gaslighting. And so this is, you know, in reference to what I was talking earlier, when you have someone with attachment insecurity, great attachment insecurity, they will, as a side effect, gaslight someone. A common example is you'll have a fight and they will just be laying into you. They'll just be saying, you're so stupid. You're just so dumb. You don't know what you're talking about. Look at you. And the next day you say to them, hey, last night was kind of rough. You know, you said these things, these phrases. And they're like, I didn't say that. What are you talking about? I never said that. You're completely misinterpreting me. Okay. And if this happens over a longer period of time, it will have the side effect of gaslighting the victim into thinking, do I understand things or am I overreacting? And so the reason why this individual is doing this is in this non-purposeful category, which is the most common, is that we all operate from how we feel. We all remember how we feel. And we all do this in relationships. Every conflict you've ever had with your partner, you do this. I didn't say that. Yes, you did. You know, it's commonplace. But for the individual with tremendous attachment insecurity, one, they're so desperate for, and they're so worried they're going to lose their partner, that they will resort to anything to retain their partner, including completely discounting the other person, because they believe if I can just erase that negative thought from the other person, they will no longer think negatively about me, and thus they will never leave me. The other thing is they're so emotional. Their triggers are so quick and their emotional reactivity is so high, where someone else during a conflict might be like a 5 out of 10, and thus filtering everything through those emotions, they're always a 10 out of 10. And so they're filtering things through tremendous emotion. And when we filter perceptions and experiences through tremendous emotion, we distort it because of the way it feels, you know? Right. In their head, they're like, last night, I wasn't putting you down. You were putting me down, because that's how it felt to them. But that isn't what happened. If you recorded it, they were putting you down. But because of their distortions, because of their 18-month-old vulnerabilities, it felt as though you were putting them down. And so they're just like, that never happened. I wasn't putting you down. You were putting me down. Again, you rinse and repeat this enough times, the victim is going to start to question their sanity, because the abusive individual seems so sure of themselves. The third type is something I added on after people started writing in, which I call systemic gaslighting, which isn't technically the clinical definition, but the way I write it here is it's an effect from an ongoing unfair system of power that results in counter reactions, counter to the target, sometimes micro reactions, to calls for justice from the victim that are so comprehensive that the victim starts to question their grasp on fairness and their own victimhood. So you have, say, a woman at a place of work, and she is being discriminated against by a bunch of men, maybe even by other women. And she is at first saying, hey, I'm being mistreated here. I'm not being paid enough, or I'm not getting a promotion, or I'm being ignored in meetings or something, or I'm getting mistreated. And they just they bring it up, but the system just shuts them down repeatedly over and over again. And then over time, if you have no other support system and no other touchstone to ground you, you end up start thinking, well, I must be crazy, because no one else agrees with me. The power structure, they're supposed to know what they're doing. They don't agree with anything I'm saying. So I must be overly sensitive. And so I'm just going to believe that I'm the dumb one, and I'm just going to shut up. And so that's just, and that can happen, you know, and I think that's a viable usage of the term gaslighting, which happens all the time. Yeah.
It's hard to understand why anyone would want to treat someone they supposedly love and care about in these ways. But one of our listeners wrote in and she asked, are perpetrators consciously aware that they are being manipulative, or is this a behavior that has been modeled to them and that they learn?
Yeah. So a very small minority, say 3%-ish of perpetrators are aware. They wake up in the morning and literally say, this is what I'm going to do. They might even have planned it out. But, you know, Andrew Tate, for example, if you're aware, I can't know, but the way that it seems, he woke up in the morning and literally made choices, and it was evidence that he went on a campaign knowing that he was going to manipulate people and didn't care about anyone's feelings, and in a very classic con artist, psychopathic man. Those people are out there. They're particular. There's a spectrum, but they're very rare. Vast majority of individuals, when they're being abusive, it's an exaggeration of something that we all do. So I'll just try to figure out an example from all of us, but it's an extreme exaggeration of something that we all do. Let's say that my wife is really stressed out and she's distant from me. Like, she's cold with me. She's not trying to hurt my feelings, but she's so stressed out that she's shutting down, and I don't know she's stressed out because she hasn't told me anything about it. So all I notice is that she's being distant from me, and I might come to her and say, like, hey, how's it going? And she just frowns and she's suffering on the inside, but I don't know that. And so through my perceptions, she's being a jerk face, and maybe she doesn't even love me anymore. I don't know. And so I start to have my feelings. I start to have my conclusions. And then I might go to her, if this is prolonged and, you know, maybe there's a moment, and then I start getting a bad mood with her. She starts to pick up on that. Things kind of escalate. And then say there's a moment where I say, hey, let's have date night. And she's just like, ah, I'm kind of busy. And I've had all this built up emotion about all this built, and I'm just like, I might be destructive in that moment. You know, I might say something like, you've never loved me. I don't know what I'd say. It's hard to put myself.
I get it. When you're starting to use always and nevers.
You're a cold person who doesn't care about my feelings. You're always disregarding my feelings. You never listen to me. You never care about anything that I've ever done. And you're a horrible partner or something. It's a horrible thing to say to someone, but you know, something along those lines. That's mean. I'm being mean to her. But, you know, we've all been there, right? Sure. And if you haven't, or if you think you haven't, you're in denial. So there's that. We've all been there. And so to the abusive person, they're so hurt and so scared. And the behavior has been modeled to them to be very hurtful and very controlling that it's that times 100. So, you know, we've all been hurtful because in that moment when I'm saying that to her, I'm not trying to be nice, you know, and I'm trying to get under her skin. You know what I mean? I'm not saying, I wonder what will get under her skin. I'm just like, I'm angry, you know, and I'm blasting. And you times that by 100, and that's what an abusive person is doing.
That ties in really nicely to another question our listener sent in. We had quite a few questions around understanding exactly what you said, the difference between a really heated argument and things that are said in the heat of the moment. I've said it. I'm sure a lot of people have said it, versus verbal abuse. So can you kind of get into that?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's a spectrum and there's no scientific hard line. But generally, we want to reserve the word abuse for a certain degree of harm to another person. For example, belittling, to make someone feel like they're small, like they're stupid, like they're insignificant, insults, this kind of thing. In the example I gave, where I'm yelling at my wife, yelling, I guess is hard to imagine, but to say it's something like, you don't ever care about my feelings. That's a very common thing that I'll hear people say to their spouses. You know, that's pretty mean. It can't possibly be true. You're basically calling someone a manipulative psychopath that has no empathy, particularly for their partner, for their husband. That's quite an accusation. But, you know, depending on the situation, I don't know if my wife would feel extremely harmed by that. Whereas if I said something like, you're a fucking idiot because you completely ignored what I've been going through. You know, that's a different tone. It's a different choice of words. It's the same kind of communication, right? I'm still saying the general thing that I'm trying to get across. But I think you can usually tell the difference if you have been modeled healthy behavior or know how to tell the difference. You know, the ability to know the distinction is dependent on your self-esteem, your self-worth, and what you've seen in your life. You know, for me, I didn't grow up with any kind of abusive behavior in my household. And so when I see it, it's like, whoa. Yeah. Whereas other people, it'll just go right over their head, like it's just normal talk, you know, because it is normal talk to them. And it'll even go so far as it's not only just normal. That's the way spouses express love. People will even equate the absence of that as an absence of intensity of love and meaning. Right. That's another issue pre-insight, pre-therapy.
And I think too, isn't there, depending on the dynamics of the couple, there's oftentimes too where even some of that like sarcasm and stuff is used in kind of a jokey way that both people understand that it's not to cause hurt in their specific dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's all in what is the intent and what's the effect.
Sure.
Which can be independent of each other. But yeah, I mean, if you had a sarcastic, funny relationship and you called each other a piece of crap and it was funny to the two of you, then in that context, it's not abusive. It's the same abusive phrase, but it's not actually abusive.
Before we get into some questions regarding recovery from these type of relationships, we often hear, you know, zebras don't change their stripes. People don't change. But is that true that someone who has exhibited abusive behavior can't change?
Well, a sadistic psychopath, someone with a legit personality disorder, is in all likelihood going to have a really hard time changing and even wanting to change. If Andrew Tate is a psychopath, which I can't know, the chance that somehow individuals like that will say, I think there's something wrong with me. I would like some help with it. Yeah, it's just so small. If they did want to change, they could. There's plenty of psychopaths and sadistic people, for that matter, who have been treated. I've treated some of them who have been able to learn a different behavioral pattern. They can't change their personality, but they can change their impulses and trying to take other things into account. But so that's that category. And again, we're talking about a very small group of people, 3-ish% that you might run into, 1 or 2%. For everyone else, 100%, they're absolutely changeable. Again, if they seek help and if they have proper treatment. And I've treated many people. In fact, from my memory, and it's impossible to know, but we would do follow-ups with these individuals and their partners. Everyone we treated in this mandated group got better. And you would really see it, the transformation. There was very profound changes that had to happen in their personality, their attachment style, their understanding of relationships, their understanding of their own entitlement, their understanding of what a man is. All that would have to change a lot, and it did. And it took a year or two, maybe three. But when you see that transformation, when you see the light bulb go off in their head, because for them, they want attachment security, these individuals. And if you teach them an effective way to actually get that, especially if it doesn't land him in prison, but really more important, it's effective, you know, because these individuals, these abusive individuals, they're resorting to a defense, and we all do this. They're just having a particularly destructive defense. We all have defensive ways of trying to retain our attachments that shoot us in the foot, that ultimately don't work. We're trying to make them work, but they ultimately don't. In my scenario with my wife, if I were to pull away and passive aggressively give her the silent treatment, that might be a way of me trying to get her to notice that I'm hurt or to stop doing that or something. That's not effective. It's not going to work. It's not healthy. Everyone does this. The abusive person does it in a particular way, and their reactivity is very high. Once you can help them to gain awareness and to heal from the attachment traumas that they've been through, which they've all been through, then absolutely, they can get better. And I've treated many people along those lines.
Quick follow-up question. So obviously you were treating, I'm understand that you were treating people individually or as a couple or both?
Yeah, both, and also group. So the mandated folks were in a group, 6 to 10 individuals. But in my private practice, it's individuals and couples and also individuals who are victims. So I would help the victim client go home and influence the abusive person. Obviously, there's the topic of leaving the person, but often that wasn't at the top of the priority list at the beginning. And I could help the victim to engineer their relationship to be different, you know, which isn't super easy, but can be done. Also with families, you know, there's abusive to children. There's also abusive children. There's abusive teenagers that I would treat as well.
It's very interesting. I had a lot of questions about how can someone support a loved one or a friend who is in an abusive relationship, but they're not quite ready to leave. So how could someone show support and say, I love you, I'm here for you, but also not necessarily agree that they're still in that relationship? Like, how does what does that look like to you?
Yeah, well, it's the same with me as a therapist. When I'm treating someone and I'm witnessing them, say it's an individual, and I determine that they're in an abusive relationship, I might even say that to them. I care deeply about them. It's to some extent my job to help them to be safe and to not be harmed and traumatized. I have a heart, and also it's sort of my job to try to help. And so it can become very frustrating and very hurtful, very painful to watch someone that you care about go through pain. So the first thing that clinicians do, and other people should as well, is to just take note of their own feelings. Because if you don't have awareness of your feelings, then you'll just act in an undifferentiated manner. And often you'll make mistakes and you'll be counter to what you ultimately want, which is to help your friend. For example, for myself, I might be hoping that the person leaves, but of course, I don't just tell people that. I might say something like, you know, as your therapist, I really care about you. And I had to say, as a human being, I kind of wish you left this person, but you know, I'm not going to tell you that because that's your choice. And I'm not going to judge you if you stay. But I just have to say that's present, you know, just kind of put that out there and move on. So I might do that. But if I don't note my feelings about it, I might get frustrated over time that they're not leaving. And I might, you know, I might be subtly asking questions and they might be making excuses for the abusive person. Like, well, you know, they'll get better. It's not that bad. And I'm like, it's not that, it's really bad what you're talking about. And then I start to get frustrated because now I'm kind of fighting with my client or my friend. I'm in opposition to them and I'm judging them because my pain could be alleviated if they left the person. My worry would be alleviated if they left the person. That's not them. These are my feelings. It's not their fault that I'm having these feelings. I'm affected by the individual, but I have to take ownership of my feelings. It's like, okay, I'm starting to take on the responsibility of this. It's not my job. And I understand this is a bigger issue than just me saying, you know, maybe you should leave. It's okay to have these feelings and I might express them, I might get support from, but if I just operate from those feelings, I'll chastise, I'll withdraw, I'll judge, I'll, you know, whatever. There's actually a great scene in Big Little Lies where second season and the therapist is doing this actually to Nicole Kidman character and pretty awful therapy, honestly. But, you know, kind of normal for therapists to do that at times. So it's not like on the scale of things, extremely strange, but yeah, it wasn't good therapy, you know, because the idea is somehow like, oh, I never thought of that. Thank you, therapist, for saying you can leave someone, really? You know, it's such a, it's like Captain Obvious.
Moment above your head, yeah. You never thought of that before.
Right. Thanks for therapist explaining to me that I could leave someone. Okay. You know, the thing that it ignores is that one, it's hard to leave. It's scary to leave, but it's also, there's often a tremendous amount of attachment to these individuals. It's not just bad. It's good at times. You know, it's not all abuse. There's tenderness or love or attachment or, you know, dependency or whatever. There's that. The other aspect is a lot of victims, particularly if they're in a prolonged experience of abuse, not only from the abusive relationship itself present, but, you know, when they were growing up, they have schemas potentially where they feel they're incompetent and unworthy, and they've experimented with being alone. They might have even left their partner for a period of time. But when they're alone and they have no one to replace that void, it's worse for them. And that's hard to imagine. But for people with these kinds of upbringings, these kinds of schemas, it's worse for them to be alone and not abused, which is great, but to be alone with their own feelings of incompetence, their own fears of screwing everything up, their own worries of they'll never find anyone else. And, you know, they're quite desperate. And so that's why both people often in these relationships have tremendous attachment security. Not always, but in the prolonged experience, the prolonged relationships, they often both come from a very similar childhood, but they each are taking different sides of the coin. And so to just suggest to someone to leave without there being a tremendous attachment safety net, often in the form of therapy and a pretty robust support system, which the abusive person has eliminated from their life, you know, to just suggest that to them is naive to that reality for them. So just understand all that kind of foundation and then be there for them. Victims need friends too. They need to go to the movies or have a drink or have a laugh or something, watch 90 Day Fiancé or something. And, you know, it's fine. You know, you don't have to be constantly focused on someone's victim status. You know, they're more than that. They're a full human being. In a pinch, I would say, be a good friend and listen and don't pressure. You could certainly say how you feel. When I hear your stories, it sounds awful and I'm scared for you and I wish I could snap my fingers and take away the abuse or snap my fingers and make you leave. But I know that's stupid because, you know, that it's more complicated than that. But I'm here for you. And, you know, you can talk about whatever you want to talk about. I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to run away. I'm not going to freak out.
Well, one question that we had that kind of shocked me when we got it in, because it wasn't something I'd thought about. It wasn't even something that I've discussed in my therapy journey. So I found it really interesting, but in order, again, to keep this listener's story private to them and respect that, I'm going to talk about my own experience. I had a very bad relationship that escalated to stalking and harassment, and it wasn't physical during the course of the relationship, but when I left, there was moments where it definitely crossed those boundaries. And so now the question from this listener was, how do you discuss, as you enter the dating world again, how do you discuss triggers? For instance, mine, I have a very quick reaction to someone touching my neck or putting their arm around me when I'm not expecting it, because I had trauma revolving my neck in that relationship. And it's completely involuntary, right? I just naturally flinch or pull away. you can tell in my body that I'm getting defensive because my body feels like I need to protect myself. And it's not a reaction that they're expecting or desiring from trying to, you know, cuddle up and be lovey-dovey with you. So how do you, especially in new relationships, discuss some of those triggers without having to kind of dump a lot of information you might not be ready to share with that person yet?
Yeah, I'm sort of smirking because I recommend dumping. I'm married, so I don't have to deal with this anymore. But so it's easy. It's easy for me to say. But I would, my recommendation along, and there's a various different topics in this category, which is it's a litmus test. Lay it out there. First date. And if they run, screw them. You don't want to date them anyway. You know, if they're that afraid of a real conversation, like really, you're looking for someone that's that fragile and superficial and hasn't been around the block, because the person you want to keep is the person that stays. And the person you really want to keep is the person who's like, oh my God, I wanted to say something too. And often there's a genderized situation to this too, that somehow men don't have these experiences. They do. Men are abused. Men are traumatized. So if you're heterosexual, you're a woman and cis and you're dating, don't think like you're this weird thing. So shame is the enemy. And so if you're ashamed, you got to attack that. And that is not okay. There's nothing to be ashamed of, obviously, for someone else to attack you and traumatize you. You're having a normal human reaction, as you were saying, Elise. There's nothing shameful about it. And if you present it with no shame, and they don't like it, like red flag. So, you know, you just say, hey, by the way, you know, before anything happens, I've been traumatized around my neck by a previous partner. And so don't make any fast lunge movements towards my neck. Really, in general, don't make any fast lunge movements anywhere. Yes. But
maybe, but not at all.
but don't even, you know, because I don't want you to do something and have me like have an involuntary reaction. I don't want to put you through that. You know, I don't want to make you feel bad because you're just trying to be nice. So, you know, just duly, you know, noted. If you say it without any shame and the person has an ounce of maturity, I can't imagine them reasonably saying that you're a freak for saying something about it.
Yeah, I think because I am not married, so I am in this weird dating world right now. Just from my own experience, I think you build it up in your mind a little bit about what they could say in response to it. I have never been with someone who didn't, when I presented it, like, hey, this is what's going on. I'm not trying to kill the mood. This is what's happening. I've never been responded to in the same shame that I'm putting on it myself. So just a little tidbit from someone who's been through it. And Annie has one last question, and then we are going to let you go, unfortunately.
I do. Yes. When people finally do decide to move forward in their dating life, is there any advice you have about building confidence and trusting yourself to choose partners that won't repeat the same pattern?
Well, it'll help if I speak directly to Elise, actually, in this moment, because it'll just provoke real sort of in the moment sort of stuff for me. So Elise, you have been traumatized. That wasn't your fault. And you deserve to know that. And you deserve to also know that you're strong because you survived. If anything, it's a strength that you managed to get through it. You got out of it. You valued yourself. And you deserve to recover. You deserve to have a partner that you can trust, that trusts you, that is not going to hurt you, that has the normal ups and downs, gets upset, but doesn't exploit you, doesn't go after you, doesn't scare you, doesn't stalk you, doesn't try to coerce you to do things, doesn't belittle you, doesn't make you feel like you deserve it or that you're small. They're out there and you deserve that. I'm glad that this has happened, and really absorb it, you know, that these fellas, I'm guessing fellas that you've dated, are they fellas that you've dated?
Yeah.
They have responded in a way that showed that you could trust and that you can say your experience and that you can be vulnerable and because it's, you know, it's a vulnerable thing. You're putting it out there. You know, they could make fun of you. They could run away. They could try to exploit it or something. And they didn't do that, you know, and really absorb that. It's like, oh, what I went through, that was anomalous. That was a weird, strange individual with normal attachment injuries, but a very strange, destructive way of dealing with it. That's not the norm, you know, and the way he treated me has no indication of who I am. They're the weirdo. They're this weird, strange creature that came out of nowhere. And I thought it was normal for a time, but it wasn't. It's just bad luck. I just happened to come across, and the rest of the world I can trust. I'm worthy of that. I can attain that. I deserve it. And I shouldn't be afraid of the entire world. I might be a little bit more discerning, and I might look for a little bit more red flags. I might pull out a little faster. I don't know. But, you know, in all likelihood, things should work out, maybe, as long as I have support. Anyway, so Elise, I hope that you have been able to build that back up for yourself, to become stronger because of it, to cry all the tears and to have all the grief and to, well, let me ask you, I don't know if you want to answer this, but
no, I'm pretty open.
Are you in therapy?
Yes.
And do you talk about the traumas that you've been through with this past partner?
Not as much anymore. I did leading up to doing this series. I talked with Annie about it. She agreed to do this series. And then I knew it would bring up a lot of emotion, sharing a story, even just parts of it so publicly. But it was about 13 years ago. So it's something that we talked about very heavily. I was set up with a counselor who then I moved forward with a different therapist that fit me a little bit better. But now it's more of something I just touch in about when I know there's going to be something that triggers those emotions back up. Sharing that story, I had a lot of that same like fight or flight body response just by talking about those memories. So I went back to therapy leading up to this series just to make sure I was checking in.
And has your self-esteem still been impacted by these experiences?
I think I would be dishonest to say no. It impacts me in the way that I still question who I choose. I feel like I definitely know my worth, but I question my picker, if you want to put it that way, because I didn't see what I felt like I should have seen as red flags and warning signs. So it's something that I tend to almost overthink as I get into a new relationship is, am I going to find myself in this same situation because I'm overlooking things that I should be seeing or that others saw that I didn't?
Do you think there's a deficit in your picker or your personality that made it so you didn't see the signs, or did you see it as just like you didn't know because no one told you?
I think it was mainly just because I was young and I'd never been through an abusive relationship before. Like I said, I had parents that kind of were great models of a great relationship in my eyes who I wanted to emulate. But yet, I think that's why I didn't trust myself as I saw this great relationship growing up. Of course, they had their struggles and their obstacles. But then how did I choose something so different when I say that this is what I wanted?
Yeah, it sounds like you're saying there's something wrong with you, which is not fair to you. I don't know if you wanted this conversation to go here, but the language you're using is more the prior, what you're, you know, this like, how did I do that? You did it because even... I'm a therapist. I've treated perpetrators. Years into that experience, I've entered into abusive relationships myself, like very unpleasant, pretty severe situations. I should know better. And I do know better. No one knows better. No one can protect against these kinds of people. There's no amount of education. There's no amount of, if a victimizer finds you and you come across them, they're going to get you. It's just a matter of how long you realize and what your strategy is to get out and how much support you have to get out. Everyone's susceptible. So there's nothing wrong with your picker. There's nothing, you drew, it was bad luck. You know better now. You could still find yourself 6 months in saying, how did I get here? It's kind of luck of the draw, you know, because if I hadn't met those people, I would never have been in those situations. It doesn't have anything to do with me, and it has nothing to do with you. It has to do with the abusive person. That's what's to blame.
I love that. I feel like that was really good for you to hear, Elise, because yeah, it's always nice coming from someone else who has experience in the field to tell you.
Well,
it's
I
not
think
your
it's
fault,
something that everyone that goes through this experience has to hear, not just one time by one person. That it's nice to hear it again and again. To be honest, my therapist tells it to me when we do talk about this, that it's okay. This isn't, you know, something that you chose. I tend to frame things as I chose this, but then I'm reminded very quickly that I didn't choose this for myself. I chose to date the person. I didn't choose the actions that followed.
Yeah. And once they get their hooks into you, it's really hard to just bow out. You know, it's terrifying. yeah, there's just no way around it. You know, there are things you can do to try to avoid it, but when, you know, it's sort of like getting sick or COVID or something. You take all the precautions, but you can't just bury yourself in a hole. You've got to live your life to some extent, right? And, you know, you got to date. And so it's sometimes you're going to come across one of those people and they're going to effectively trick you in the beginning, or you'll have so much chemistry with them that you'll just overlook it a little bit. You know, that happens.
All right. Well, I'm going to take a big, deep breath out. And thank you for saying all of that. It's like I said, it's always good to hear a reminder of that it isn't your fault, and for listeners as well to understand that. You know, I'm sure Dr. Honda will agree with me, and I say therapy is a very amazing tool if you find yourself in any of these situations. But if you resonated with anything that we talked about today, please check out www.thehotline.org. Of course, we'll have that in our show notes. And like I said, we'll be following this interview up with an interview with a survivor who works with thehotline.org to talk about safety plans and measures that you can take to protect your safety, especially in the age of social media. So if you are like me and you love to figure out the why behind people's actions, or you're a fan of reality TV, I would highly suggest that you guys check out Psychology in Seattle YouTube series, where Dr. Honda watches clips from reality TV. I think you've done one or two episodes of The Bachelor, which is my background. Mm-hmm. I was on The Bachelor, so I'm going to not watch those ones, but I watched the 90 Day Fiancé ones. And I would really hope that you guys also check out his podcast, where he does a lot of deep dives into relationship dynamics and psychology. And with that, Dr. Honda, thank you so much for joining us. It was so nice to speak with you again.
Yes, thank you so much, Dr. Honda. Our listeners are in for a treat, and I cannot wait for them to get their earbuds on this episode, because not only was it educational, but it was very interesting. So I really appreciate your
Thanks.
Time today.
One final note.
Yes.
Listeners out there, if you care about Elise and Annie and they've helped you, tell them, because as a content provider myself, it is the wind beneath our wings. We do it because of you. We want you to be helped or to be assisted in some way, or to be moved, or to not be lonely, to be justified, to reduce your shame. And Elise is, you know, really putting yourself out there. And if you have it in you to tell them that they're helping you, then I would do so.
I appreciate you saying that so much. Thank you again. Hopefully we'll chat with you soon, maybe about a lighter topic, but on a true crime podcast, probably not. Awesome. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now you can see why I enjoy his content so much. I really appreciate him coming on. I can't say that enough. I know he is a very busy man. He puts out videos like every day, it seems like. There's always something to watch. So again, I will have all of his channels and his podcast listed in our show notes. A huge shout out to him for taking the time to do this. You might hear my voice quivering a little bit because I got a little emotional at the end of that. I didn't anticipate it to go in that direction. And it's tough to share this, but like you said, I don't want to have a story without that story having purpose. So if anyone, again, resonated with any of this, like, this is why we're doing this series, so that you can recognize this as you enter the dating field, maybe earlier than I did when I was in a relationship. Or if you're, you know, have friends or family that are in this, this gives you some tips of how to be supportive to them, and, you know, from a professional that knows his stuff. Obviously, he's been working in this field for quite a long time. Ugh, Annie.
His brain is a beautiful place. I would love to just go in there for a second, because yeah, not only was he knowledgeable, but he was super interesting to me. I'm on the edge of my seat, like, just tell me everything you know. And thank you to all of our listeners who wrote in those questions. We had quite a few people who kind of asked the same question, so I'm glad that we got those answered. And I hope that people found it beneficial, but like Elise said, we're always going to be linking off those resources where if you don't feel comfortable coming to us, I do not blame you. But always know there is help out there for you. And we are rooting for you if you're in a position that's really difficult. And we love you, even though we don't know you. I'm sending all my love to our listeners.
It's a long journey, but as you can hear in my voice, again, here I am getting emotional on this podcast. It's a long journey, but it's worth it. The other side truly is greener than where you're at. So again, as always, please check out thehotline.org if anything that we talked about today is sitting heavy with you. There's so many resources for creating safety plans.
All right. Well, it's me again, just chiming in here at the end. If you want to listen to Case of the Sunday Scaries, I recommend checking it out. And everyone, please, please take care of yourself, because you deserve it. You really, really do.